I'm Dr. Maple Go, and welcome to Doctor Not Otherwise Specified, also known as Doctor NOS. This podcast is to provide guidance for our junior doctors to navigate medical and non-medical careers. I hope all the doctors out there can get something out of this, whether they're specified or not. Kia pai tora. Haremai to another episode of Dr. NOS. Today we have Dr. Luke Wee. Luke is a GP from South Auckland. He's previously served at Mercy Ships as a junior doctor and was involved in the charity in New Zealand. Being Malaysian, he enjoys good food and learning many languages. But unfortunately, due to the lack of travel, he feels he's lost his marbles and jumbled up his French and te reo Māori. So thank you very much for being here with me today, Luke. How are you?
Good, people, and nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for being here. So let's start from the beginning. Tell me about how you started medical school and why you picked medicine.
Sure, yes. Yeah, so I'm from Malaysia originally. I grew up in a small town called Kuala Terengganu in Malaysia until I was 17. And when I was finishing high school, I was quite confused about what I wanted to do. I was quite into the arts, so I wanted to do drama, but my parents thought it was a really bad idea. And then I wanted to be a pharmacist because my family thought it's good to run a small business. And after speaking to a few pharmacists, I felt that it was not for me. And I felt that perhaps medicine was better because it's a way for me to give back to the community. Which was something that was quite important for me back then and still today. And I took the leap of faith, applied for some scholarships overseas, and got a scholarship to study medicine. Back in Malaysia, I was fairly isolated from what was happening in the world, so I never knew where New Zealand was. I don't know what it looks like. But then I think as young as and foolish as you were, you sort of think, took the leap of faith, and I came to New Zealand. I did my medical school in Auckland, and my life changed ever since.
Wow. And so you were uprooted from Malaysia and started up in Auckland. How did you find the cultural shift and adjusting?
Yeah, so I like to pride myself as someone quite versatile and quite in exploring new places. So uprooting myself and replanting myself in new places. But well, I think the initial adjustment felt easy, but it was not till a year later that I felt that, hey, there was actually quite a lot of differences in terms of New Zealand culture and Malaysian culture. And it took a few years subsequently to actually readjust myself to a new way of thinking and a new way of presenting myself to society. Yeah.
What were some of the differences you noticed?
I think it's just some of the differences will be perhaps values of egalitarianism, liberal social values, maybe a less hierarchical societal structure. I'm more open and the people are not afraid of speaking up for things that they believe in. And a whole lot of different intangible values that it's quite different from Asian cultures.
It's quite interesting when you move here, you realize what freedom of speech is and freedom of
possibly.
Choice.
Yeah, that's right. So there's kind of different way of being, a different way of conducting yourself in a more collectivistic societies.
Yeah, and then you found your way through medical school and then you practice as a junior doctor. So whereabouts were you placed and how did you end up in Mercy Ships?
Sure, yeah. Towards the end of my medical school, I applied for jobs across New Zealand and I landed up in a smaller hospital in Wellington, so it's a small hospital. There's no registrar, so the team consists of the house surgeon and the consultant. And it was a really good experience for me, so where I got a lot of hands-on experience. I had a whole range of runs that I really enjoyed, including emergency medicine, general medicine, and psychiatry. And towards the end of my house surgeon, yes, I felt that something was missing. And I was at a verge of burnout, and I felt that I needed to move on. But I just didn't know what to do until the ad for Mercy Ships pop up on my computer screen one day. And I thought, hey, that's really interesting. And I looked at the different positions available, and position of the hospital physician came up, and I applied for it. And within a week later, I got accepted. And 3 months later, I was on a plane to the Republic of Congo.
Wow. Wow. When you were applying, actually, what were the things that they were looking for?
I think one thing that was fairly important is the sense of genuine desire to make a difference in the lives of people, a confidence level to face various clinical situations, because obviously working in a resource setting, then you need to have a certain level of confidence to make clinical decisions, and with support may not necessarily easy to get. And obviously the alignment of values between the applicant and the organization is also quite important, where compassion and a general desire to serve the marginalized is something that Mercy Ships sort of hold strongly to.
I see. And then tell me about your work in Mercy Ships. What does it look like?
So as a junior hospital physician, I work alongside a senior physician, which is essentially another GP space at a ship. So the ship that I was on had 440 crew altogether with about 100 hospital beds. So there are two physicians, myself and my supervisor, and a whole team of different surgeons working across four operating rooms. So my day is pretty standard with most hospitals, really, where you start the day with a ward round between the surgeons and the physicians. Like you see the patients, you check them post-operatively, make sure that they're well, review blood test results, review the investigations, and discharging them when they're ready. And obviously, as a physician, I was not involved with the surgeries, but my role as part of the team really is to ensure that the surgical services run smoothly. And the second part of my role really is to assess the patients before surgery. So as a house surgeon, you're probably familiar with preoperative anesthetic assessments where we work up patients before they come for surgery. And in some of the cases, can be quite interesting and can be quite challenging. So there was really good learning for me. And on top of the pre-operative assessment, I also run outpatient clinic, reviewing patients after surgery and liaising with the senior physician and the surgeons in regards to their care.
Right. How long was this placement? Like, I'm just trying to picture.
I'm not sure whether you're familiar with Mercy Ships. I think they do visit a country for 10 months where they dock at a port in West Africa, West or Central Africa. They stay stationary for the whole year, and they run a pretty tight ship in the sense that they select patients from surgical camps, and then they book them for surgery, bring them in the day before for surgery, and discharge them once they recover. So I was there for half the time because I couldn't find enough. I was in a transition time between jobs, and I could only serve 5 months.
I see. I'm just wondering, in terms of the clinics, because you said you had clinics and followed people up, what was the period of follow-up that patients had?
I suppose because of the lack of primary care infrastructure, a follow-up can be a bit of a challenge, especially if you go through complex maxillofacial surgeries or reconstruction surgeries. So patients tend to stay in a halfway home where they get housed for a period of 4 weeks of surgery. Outside of, and obviously during that time they might come back to the ship on a daily basis or a weekly basis to receive post-operative checks.
Right, I see. And What was the resource like on the ships? Like, if you needed to give somebody
It's pretty well resourced. If you want to check on our website, we do run a fairly modern facility with 100 beds. But then we do have 4 operating rooms to high standards. We do have 2 high dependency unit beds, ventilators, and we do have a CT scan, and we do have surgeons to come from all across the world with similar sort of expectation of high quality medical services. And I think we, as a wider medical charity, we try to keep our standards up.
Right. And in terms of like medications, for example, if people needed antibiotics after their care, was that delivered from the ship itself?
We stock our own medications and then we stock as many of our own treatments on board.
Wow, that's incredible.
And that's probably quite important, because from a medication point of view, we just can't be sure of the quality as well as the reliability of a locally sourced medication.
Yeah, that's right. Yep, there's a strong prevalence of counterfeit medications overseas. So yeah, definitely is important to get sources from home. So yeah, I'd love to hear, what were the kind of conditions you'd often see on the ship?
Sure. Okay. So from my perspective as a hospital physician, the range of conditions that I see probably will be different from what the surgeons would see. I think the list is probably quite wide from a surgical point of view, but from a medical point of view, so we often see cases like hypertension, diabetes, rheumatic heart disease already presents with the patient before the surgery and is discovered the abnormalities that we have to deal with. Undiagnosed atrial fibrillation, anemia, malaria, and HIV. So the sort of part of it is bread and butter of what we do in general practice in New Zealand, and some of them are conditions that we sometimes don't see over here. So it was a good clinical challenge for me.
I do wonder, you know, a scenario that pops into mind is that sometimes in my preoperative assessments, somebody might have really, for example, uncontrolled hypertension. And so in that situation, if you saw somebody like that, would you manage their hypertension and get their operation? And then what happens if they need antihypertensives post-operative for life and they can't get access to it?
So that's the challenge that we face, where you may be able to control the hypertension before surgery, but what happens after surgery? And depends on where the patient's from, whether they're from a major city, a smaller city, or in a remote village, and what's their access to modern medication. So from the ship's perspective, we can provide them with a month of supply upon discharge. Obviously, we have instructions to resume their medication with their local doctors, and obviously, there's a bit of an ethical issue too, where we don't want to start them on treatments that is not available at home, and we want to keep the cost as low as possible, which means that we have to choose medications that they're more likely to be able to afford and source locally.
Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma to be in, isn't it? Yeah.
And you don't want to end up in a situation where the patient is left worse off after they've seen you compared to before they see you.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I'd love to hear from your experiences that you had there. What did you enjoy the most about it?
So I think, apart from clinical medicine, I think the biggest reward really is the relationship with patients and our colleagues. I think perhaps as a GP, human relationships are more important to me than the joys of diagnosing the right condition or giving the right treatment. So I think I find it really powerful and rewarding to myself when someone like myself from a different culture, language, ethnic background, being able to transcend differences to a totally different culture and different worldview and different way of life. And it's not so much the technology or the fancy treatments or even our good intentions, but it's the presence and the human touch and the genuine authenticity that bridges that gap between the doctor and the patient. And I think that's really powerful too. And obviously, learning local languages, speaking French to some people in Central Africa was really fun. And checking out local places, seeing how they live, and sort of connecting with people at their level rather than from our Western sort of way of life.
Mm. And you must have an affinity to language, just being someone who's probably multilingual and polyglot from Malaysia, just because that's the standard in Malaysia. So I imagine picking up French and now picking up Tadeo must probably be fairly easy to you compared to the average population. So that's amazing.
They say that your ability to learn a new language drops as you grow older. And I do find that as I grow older, it's a bit harder to pick up a new language. But I suppose when I was with Mercy Ships, I was much younger. So I find that it was not too difficult. Yeah. And then obviously coming from Malaysia, where it's such a multicultural society, you're sort of forced to interact with people from different backgrounds and to speak and to connect with various people. So I find it really, really sort of helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And on the flip side of that, you know, there were obviously highlights and parts that you enjoyed, but what were some of the challenges of working on Mercy Ships?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, as a junior doctor, I think there were a few challenges apart from general challenges. I think as a junior doctor, I went into a global health setting, possibly underprepared. I could have gone much later in my career. And perhaps I will have more knowledge and perhaps more experience that I bring with me. Because at times I felt that I was trying to dig in, I didn't know what to do. And then hindsight's always helpful, with I could have done that, I could have done this, I could have done that. But nevertheless, it was a good experience for me. And I think dealing with different medical cultures was another challenge for me. Coming from New Zealand, which is a really small country, we are probably underrepresented on the global health stage, where there's not many doctors or nurses from New Zealand who serve overseas. So having to meet health professionals from the States, UK, Australia, or Europe, there's always that tension between different ways of doing medicine, and having to adapt and to learn from one another was somewhat challenging, but equally rewarding.
What were some of those differences?
I think American medical culture is more hierarchical. There's more reverence to doctors, and this higher level of respect. And being a resident or being a doctor without residency, but as junior doctors in the UK based system, we are perceived to be someone who hasn't got any experience at all. So if you're not a resident and you're not a consultant, you're just a medical student. So finding my place in a very regimented medical system is quite challenging.
Right, that's very interesting that the perceptions are still so different to us. And
yeah, because the residency system in the States sort of streamline medical students from the day where you graduate to the point where you finish your trainings, whereas in the UK-based system, you can remain a non-trainee registrar for many years before you choose a specialty. And after you choose a specialty, not having a specialty that you train in, it's something that is not acceptable in the American system.
That's really interesting.
And then, people who take different career pathways might be seen with suspicion.
Right, I see. Okay. So for people trying to apply to get onto Mercy Ships, would you recommend that they were on a training program or on the other end of it?
I would suggest that being on a training program will be helpful, as it gives you more credibility and more respectability within this medical subculture, and having more years of experience will be helpful too.
Do you think, if you went now as a GP, it would be different for hierarchy and different for experience?
I think at different stages of a career, it's rewarding at different levels. If I were to go back again, and I will do the hierarchy My experience might be different.
Yeah, fair enough. So, I mean, I do wonder with mercy ships, I have some very basic questions to ask, which is, are they, for one, are they faith-based or religiously
Yeah,
affiliated?
so Mercy Ships is a faith-based organization, and it is, I think it is a pretty Christian faith-based healthcare service, and as part of their recruitment strategy, as well as their organizational strategy.
Right, okay. And the people who are applying to go, whether you're a resident or not, or any other people working there, do you have to be affiliated with that religion?
Not really. I think we do see people from different backgrounds and different faith backgrounds, and I think as long as you don't disagree or you're accepting of the Christian Identity Act organization, I think there's no reason to feel unwelcome.
Okay. And with the work on Mercy Ships, I'm just wondering, is it just volunteer based? Like, do they pay for your board and everything?
Yeah, so not only that you're volunteering your time, you're also volunteering your money as well as your resources to be part of this charity. So I do have to pay for my board meals and my stay there.
Right, okay. And how much should one budget to be on Mercy Ships?
And yeah, I can't remember on top of my head, but I think you can possibly check it out on your website. So yeah, I think a few hundred US dollars a month.
I see. Okay. All right. That's very helpful to know, just because for anybody who's looking to get in, and I mean, it's helpful to know that you have to prepare yourself financially as well as prepare
Yeah,
yourself for the experience.
and then a lot of people think that we coming from the West, that our skill set and our experience is something really valuable, but what we also have to understand that when we actually go, we actually gain more than we gain more than we give, and I think the price that you pay for serving is actually immeasurable compared to the gain received on a personal and professional level.
I see. Yeah. And then after that, after you served on Mercy Ships, what have you been doing since then?
So yeah, I've done a lot of things. I went to Australia to part of training in palliative medicine, and so that was really cool. I came back to New Zealand and resumed my career in general practice, and I trained in general practice for years, and I'm now working in a variety of settings. I work for a Māori health clinic, and I also run my own practice in central Auckland.
All right. Tell me about your work in the Māori health practice.
Was really good. I joined them in April this year, and it was a personal and professional journey, sort of weaving myself into Māori health. I've always had interest in Māori health since medical school, but really haven't really got an opportunity to work in that until the pandemic this year. I think learning theory was really useful and really rewarding for me, and I think and it sort of gives me that immersion into the Māori worldview and understanding where your patients come from and what the worldviews, spiritual values, cultural values are, and makes me a better physician as well as a better person. And it's very easy to talk about changing society, bridging health inequities, and doing a lot of cool things on a systemic level, but on a personal level, until we are willing to put ourselves outside of our comfort zone and or even linguistic comfort zone, then we won't really have that credibility to say that we are truly serving and truly making a difference in our world.
Yeah, I agree. Language is so important. It's a vessel for us to articulate our feelings, but also it's a vessel for articulating our narrative. It tells the story of who we are and where we're from and our whakapapa, and it allows us to create rapport with our patients. And so, yeah, learning te reo is really important.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in the message that we want to bring to our patients is that we are genuine, we are authentic, and we want to be present with you in your health journey. And so we can communicate that either through our actions, through our efforts, and through our personal initiative. I think all of that contributes to a stronger relationship between you and the patient.
Yeah, agree. I took a year's course with the Te Wānanga Aotearoa, and it's really more understanding the culture, but also basic introduction, you know, describing things like the pen is on the table kind of thing. So I can ask people where their pain is, and I can introduce myself and listen to their mihi, but I can't say I could hold any kind of conversation in Te Reo Māori. Yeah,
All
so that's my
right,
limitation.
so I'm no better than you, and I'm one legend myself.
Yes, absolutely. We are doing our best, and so yeah, it's good to see people learn. And you know, when you're looking at all the work that you're doing, you're clearly passionate about health inequities, clearly passionate about Haere Māori. I'm just wondering, in the future, do you ever think you'll go back to Worsley Ships?
And yeah, I think in a heartbeat I will go. And then since 2015, when I was in the Republic of Togo, I've returned back to Mercy Ships in 2017. It's to cover another physician who went home for a holiday. It was really a good 2 weeks break from New Zealand healthcare to the Republic of the Benin. So yeah, I'm looking forward to serving in the future.
Yeah, that's exciting. And is it a kind of ship that you can take your family with you?
So I think there's always a shortage of space, and there's always that risk where people use it as a means to go on a family holiday, and then I think they're quite careful to ensure that there's genuine reasons to bring a family abroad. So there's a school abroad for kids and for teenagers. So yeah, if you were serving long term, you can certainly bring your family.
Right, okay, I see. So there must be like a duration threshold, maybe like a year or something if you were going to be displaced for a long time. Oh, I see. Okay, that's fair enough. And so for you, how old are your kids and would you ever consider
Oh
doing
no, we
that?
just had a 1 year-old baby, so I'm still fairly new to the parenting sort of
Right.
career.
Congratulations though. Yeah.
Thank you.
It must be tough, like your baby has grown up in a very lockdown kind of world, a very different reality.
Yeah, it is challenging having to look after baby from home and not having daycare to go to. But we are making the best out of a challenging time.
Yeah, absolutely. And before I wrap up, I'd love to hear what work-life balance means to you. What is work-life balance? What's self-care?
Sure. Okay. So I think the ability to draw boundaries. So I think before I had my baby working 6 days to 7 days a week, and that was completely unsustainable. And having a child sort of forced me to reevaluate my priorities. And now having holding a few positions in different organizations, time management is really important. But more importantly, being able to draw boundaries where you stop checking emails after 5, you don't answer phone calls, and to be able to compartmentalize different challenges that appears during the day. So I might have a workplace problem in workplace A, and I have a different challenge in workplace B, but being able to switch on and switch off when I move from one place to another, that's really helpful. And
Yeah.
not allowing that to overflow to your personal space after 5.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, time is precious, and I imagine now that you have your 1-year-old and at home as well. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think as part of our leadership growth, time management and self-care is important, because health leadership is not a race, it is a marathon. And you have to look after yourself in the long haul in order to be able to serve others and to lead people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and we're also faced with this disposition often because there are always going to be sick people, there are always going to be health inequities, there are always going to be problems to solve. And so it's really hard to switch off, and we have to learn how to create a more sustainable career.
Yeah, that's right. I think political narrative today speaks highly of reducing inequities and putting things at an ideological level where us as an individual have to respond to. My approach is rather than making these ideologies mine, I see my participation in achieving health equity as a personal relational mission, rather than burning myself out trying to do a lot of things at the same time, I would like to change the world one person at a time. Whereas when you try to internalize an external political ideology into yourself, then it's too much to carry. Whereas if you see changing the world as one-on-one, and then it's more sustainable, and it's coming from a general practice point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you very much for your time today, Luke. I know you've been very busy, and so I really appreciate being able to lock you down for this time of the weekend.
All right, thank you. No, yeah. It's a pleasure talking to you, and I really enjoyed that discussion.
This podcast was made possible by the New Zealand Doctors Residents Association Education Trust. Thank you for listening. Mā te wā.